It is truly a privilege, Ann, to be here again. My name is Scott Durbin, pastor of Cape Fellowship in Cape May Courthouse in New Jersey, and we're just glad to be able to share some of a story with you, and this continued story that's gone on in the mayor's life, and really what it is God's story that's been written through their lives, and you can find out so much more about what has happened by going to www.themattmayerstory.com. And Ann, we remind people this is not the singer. Yes. All right, there's you're not going to find music download there for
I know,
Matt
he's hoping
singing.
For some free tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt Mayer, the singer, hasn't contacted me yet for my front row seats for being his second mom.
Right, right. We should advertise for him, maybe.
But. We should. But if anybody knows him, please send him our broadcast. Maybe we can get comped.
Exactly. But it is good to be with you. There's so much that we need to catch up on today before we even get to what we're going to talk about. So.
True, there is. Well, a couple things. The storming the gates for Tier 7 has been amazing. We thank all of you out there who are participating and fasting and praying with us every Thursday. The men on Tier 7 are so touched by this. In fact, today's blog, which this broadcast will be weeks later, but the blog that's out there today is for a person named Cindy in Texas who organizes this. And one of the things Cindy did, Scott, was she individually sent a scripture for Matt to, quote, randomly give out to the men who come to fellowship group, which was prayed over. And we know that each man got the specific scripture that God wanted to permeate in their hearts. And they were very touched by that. So if you're participating in the fasting and the praying on Thursdays, and as we've said, it could be an hour, it could be all day, it could be TV, it could be something for the men on Tier 7, you are making a difference. These men's lives are being touched and hearts are being changed. So I want to thank you for that. The other thing is we had talked about me doing that symposium, and then from the symposium, we were invited to speak at three different schools. And John and I, in the past amount of weeks, have spoken to over 1,500 students. So we're pretty excited about that. The response has been amazing. These kids are responding to the story, and hopefully this tragedy, again, is being used in a way that we never planned it to be or would never script it to be and would never want it to be in terms of it happening. But the fact that it has happened, God is using it, and hopefully these kids will make better decisions when it comes to drinking and prom and graduation and all these other things that young people are faced with.
Yeah, and I think you just sort of hit on something I want to remind people of. As you listen to the broadcast and the stuff that we talk about, nobody set out to have a train wreck. Those have been following the story for a long time. When you look over what's happened in the life of the mayors over the years, you didn't ask for it, to lose one son, to have one in prison. But it's amazing, you know, what God has made of all of that. And when you serve and love him, and we do want to be very clear, we hope that anybody who listens to this, no matter whether you're of faith or not, can grab some hope out of it, because we don't want people going through life without hope. Also, if you're really searching for the true hope, we also want you to realize that God is so much a part of all of this. Mm-hmm. And it has opened up opportunities for you to speak, to write, and maybe somewhere down the line, one of our listeners might say, hey, why don't you come out and speak for us, Ann, and tell us your story. And that would be okay, too. You've done some of that. So great opportunities there and great resources for anybody that, you know, when life happens.
Mm, absolutely. And today, we're pretty excited. I don't know if you heard somebody cough in our broadcast, but that's a guest we have.
There's somebody else in the room.
There is somebody else in the room. And we are really excited. I was trying to think of a title for today's show. And one of the first things that came to my mind was the sovereignty of God and the intimacy of God. And that's because the young man who's sitting across from me, when I look at him, that's what I think about. I think about the intimate nature of a God who pursues us and is waiting for us to, at any moment, to turn to him. And our song in the beginning of our show is Beauty Will Rise. And that's another thing. When I think of Chris, our guest today is Chris Cope, I think of Beauty Will Rise because he is an example of where God has turned ashes into beauty in so many areas of his life. And before I let Chris speak, see, Scott's already looking at me like, shut up and let him talk.
Well, now that we're done with the show and just gave everything away, we'll just...
No, now that I just have to say that Chris, and I will try to say this without getting emotional, which will be a feat. So, Lord, just let me say it. when I look at Chris, the reason I think of the sovereignty of God is because when I first met Chris's mother, she was praying for him, and I didn't know him. But it was during a time when I was struggling with my own son. But Chris, his situation at the time was so much worse than my son John. And Chris knows this because I've shared it with him. So my prayers for my son were at the same time as my prayers for Chris. And I have to be honest, from where Chris was at in his life when I got to know his mother, I never expected Chris to live. And I have to say also, Chris, that I never expected my son to die from where he was at the same point. Mm-hmm. Having said that, Chris's life, to me, reaffirms that God knows what's best for each of us and that the sovereignty of God is what is best. And my son was taken back to heaven because that was God's will. And maybe John couldn't survive certain things. But Chris's life was turned around. So, having said that.
Yeah, having said all that, you are in for a treat to hear an amazing story. And Chris, I think you'll be the first one to say, you know, it's, you look back and recite some of the things that have happened. It's been an amazing story.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm lucky to be alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of preface this. First, I want to do this. I want to start with where you're at today. Obviously, geographically, you live here in Jersey with us. Yeah. But what do you do for a profession?
I'm the captain of a commercial fishing vessel.
Okay. And are you married? Do you have family?
I'm married, and I have a big family. I have five kids.
You're right. So that's where you're at today, but it hasn't always been that way.
No, not at all.
And so what would you say, what about what age did you start kind of getting off track with life?
I started getting off track probably when I was 13, but really, really off track probably by the time I was 15.
Yeah. But now at the same time, you were, your family, God-fearing, church-going family?
Raised in the church all my life, yep. Yeah. Went to church. Monday, Sunday night, Sunday morning, Wednesday night, and then any revivals, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
You know, whenever. Anytime the doors were open,
yeah,
you were there.
They were there. We were there. Yeah.
And so what happened around 12 or 13 into 15 years of age, your teenage years there? What did you start, what dragged you away and what got your attention?
I don't know if anything dragged me away. I think I kind of pushed myself away from things that I was seeing in the church at the time and toward other things, you know. So didn't like what I was seeing in the church, so I went and started hanging out with, you know, I mean, smoking cigarettes, doing that kind of thing.
You kind of felt like there, you saw hypocrisy
church? I was turned off by what I saw, a bunch of hypocrisy.
That's really interesting, because that's a real issue.
Oh, yeah, and I hope that if somebody's listening, they're like, oh, that whole God thing, that whole church thing. I think it's safe to say in this room that we all feel that at different times, because we've all desired something real, and we didn't find it in an organized religion type of setting. Yeah. And so we know each other pretty well, and you've shared with me some. You saw the ugly underbelly of legalism.
Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't know it was legalism or nothing. Now, later, I know. I see exactly what it was, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, you know, and I personally would say that certain amount of abuse, you know, where you just get yelled at and told what you're doing wrong and how bad you are, and you never really meet God.
Yeah.
So you went searching for something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started hanging out with the wrong people, and I was telling her earlier that throughout this whole time, I was being pulled by the Holy Spirit. Like during altar calls and during services, I was. In my gut, I was being pulled and pulled and pulled, but I was so turned off by everything that I saw, the hypocrisy in the church. And I didn't really think at that time, because I believed what I was being taught. I was like, yeah, maybe I feel this pull, but I can't live up to it. I can't.
Wow.
I can't be that. Every time I tried or even think about trying to be it, I can't. And so I would just run away from it. Like I said, I would go out to smoke cigarettes during altar calls.
Isn't that interesting that he had that Holy Spirit pull through a time where he's really rebelling in his flesh, but God is still wooing him?
The message was that you had to be flawless, but the pull was, I love you and I want a relationship with you.
Yeah, I guess that now.
You start sorting the two out, but when you're 13, when you're a teenager, actually, for most of us as human beings, it's hard when that message gets mixed up. And it gets wound together, because God certainly is calling because he loves us. So you had that pull, but you also had that I'm not so sure about this. And you went off, and would you say your first introduction to chemical dependency would have been cigarettes? It's kind of your first experiment?
Yeah, I guess so. Yep. I got addicted to cigarettes.
And then you said you were drinking alcohol.
I was drinking a lot. That was I experimented with a lot of drugs. Did a lot of drugs. The full spectrum. Even up at that young age, 15 years old, I had done acid and everything. But I didn't crave any of those even up until I was like 25, like I did at the alcohol. I wanted to drink. I wanted to go party, and I kind of wanted to be oblivious.
Okay, so you went through school. Mm-hmm. Did you graduate high school?
No, I didn't graduate high school. I got kicked out of lower for coming in drunk.
That's went the name of a high school.
Yes. Okay. Went to Christian school and tried that for a couple of times, but I kept on moving out of my house. And my parents wouldn't pay for the Christian school. So I ended up, after the second time I tried to go back to finish 10th grade, I just went and got my GED that year. I finished it. I was a good student. I was smart, but not a good student. Smart.
No, that's what I remember about you, that he's a really smart kid.
What age did you get your GED? Around 18? Like,
no, not before that. It was maybe 16.
So right you're before. Around 16 years of age. Mm-hmm. You got your GED. And what were you doing?
What did I do? I think I moved. I lived with another family for a little bit because I was friends with a couple of boys that played guitar in school, and hung out with them. And their mom was nice enough to let me live there. And then in the summertime, I'd live on the beach or wherever the party was.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I'd go back home in the winter for a little bit. Birthday time. My birthday was October 22nd, so I'd get birthday presents, stay until Christmas, and then have a new wardrobe, and I'd leave again. Pretty much the way it worked.
And so how many years did that go on?
So I was 18, I guess, because then when I was 18 is when I got in trouble. I was telling her I was walking around with a paint gun in Cape May, and I got arrested for it. Didn't have the paint gun on me. They said I had a real gun. All kinds of stuff ensued. So I moved back home for that, and I started working on the boats with my dad and making money.
And how long did you work with your dad on the boats?
I worked with him for the first time, like 6 months. At the end of it, we made close to 10 grand in a few trips. And so I had a jar full of money, and I moved out. Bought a car, rented a house, partied for the summer, went back to him in the fall to work with him because I was out of money, and did that for a few years until, I guess, I did that for 2 years, and then I went to Eastern Nazarene College for a semester.
Up in Boston?
Yeah.
You did? Yes. I didn't know that.
And that was...
How the heck did they get you there? Okay, how did that happen? What was that?
Well, girls that I had met in going to church camp as a kid saw my mom somewhere, and she's like... We miss Chris. Come up, tell him to come see us. They were going to some fish expo, and they dropped me off at Eastern Nazarene to hang out with this girl for a few days. I stayed with her friend, and I stayed there for a few days. And they're like, you need to come.
So you attempted that for, how about that?
It was a mess. I didn't go to many classes.
Right.
I think I corrupted a good amount of the student body.
Right. Well, that's...
And so as soon as that ended, you moved back here, or where did you go?
Yeah, I moved back here after that. That didn't work out. I think when I came back from there, I might have went. I cooked for a little bit because in between working on the boats, I worked. I would leave my dad and I'd go and I'd cook down in Cape May, at different places, do whatever.
Eventually, you left New Jersey, though.
Eventually, I left New Jersey. That was after I got married. I got married when I was 21, and I was with my ex-wife till I was 26.
Mm-hmm. And you were living here?
Living here. Time? Yep, mm-hmm. Yep. I had a house in Cape Woods, and I was working on the boat. And at that time, I was my dad's mate, and I had actually run the boat when he would take off. I was, at 22, I started running the boat when he would take off. I was actually having my life kind of together. Still partying whenever I'm in, but I was under control, And on the sly, doing drugs and hiding it from my wife the whole time. And then when I was 25, I started doing heroin. That eventually got a hold of me to where I couldn't control it, It beat my body down. I couldn't keep up with the fishing, and my dad knew it. He fired me.
I always wondered what that's like in your brain. Okay, now that you can look back in retrospect, what are you thinking? Is the drug such a pull that you might even be saying, I'm an idiot and I wish I wasn't, but you do it anyway?
Yeah, and it's even more than that with that. Because with other drugs, the only other drug that I really felt like I was totally addicted to was later on in life with meth. But with the heroin, the physical symptoms, because it's physically addictive, that after you do it for a certain amount of days in a row, if you don't have it, you feel like you got the worst sickness ever. You wake up, you got cold sweats, you can't sleep, your stomach's all a mess, and you can't think of nothing else because you know as soon as you do a little bit of that, that goes right away, like immediately, and you feel like you're normal again.
Is your brain, though, are you cognizant of everything? Like,
yeah, you're cognizant of everything, but your physical, your body is so physically dependent on it that it just you need it. And then on top of that, the mental addiction that you want to get high, you know, that it gets to the point. That was bad. You know, lucky for me that I had money at the time, so I never went to the spot where I was stealing from people
I was
you know, I was spending all my money and spending it all because my ex-wife was rich, so I was running up our credit cards. You know what I mean? Like, $25,000 in debt, you know, that kind of stuff.
So you were able to just cop anytime you wanted because you had
I had the resources, yeah.
Yeah, the sad part is that's why a lot of drug addicts go out and rob because that physical need, which is sad. But so you didn't have that. But all right, so you are now, let's just say, living still in New Jersey?
At 26, and I went to a rehab for the heroin because I didn't want to do that anymore because it really – that was – that drug, it took away your soul, really, it felt like to me, you know, because it – nothing, the colors didn't seem the same, music that I always liked when I'd hear it, I didn't care about, you know, nothing, it was gone, everything was like this dull feeling, it was weird, and I hated it. So I went to rehab for 40 days, and I never did that, I didn't do that again, heroin, but I came back out, and I still, I liked the needle, I did coke, or this, that, and the other, and I would drink, but I didn't do heroin.
Well, it's probably helpful for people to realize, too, an addictive behavior is... it's a mindset and an attitude. Mm-hmm. So you may go to rehab for one thing, but you have to guard your life
on everything.
On everything.
Yeah, yeah. And none of that will fix it that I find out years later until you give it all to God, really. Nothing changed in me and who I was until then.
And that's definitely something we want to, when we get there, we want to talk about because some people are like, well, what does that mean and how do you do that?
Yes.
So we want to get to that part, but you eventually... move away from New Jersey.
I moved away from New Jersey. Went down to Arizona for a year and a half with a girlfriend at the time. During that year and a half, I got caught up in the crystal meth. That's when I started getting into crystal meth. So I lived a pretty wild life down there too, you know, because I was working in two bars, cooking in the morning, cooking in the night, and then doing crystal meth. And
what's the difference of just for, you know, quick, what's the difference between crystal meth and heroin?
Like speed, one's an upper, one's an downer.
Oh, okay. All right, I didn't know
that. Yeah, I was doing stuff that would keep you awake for days.
Oh, okay. Rather than,
and you said it, you were awake for 10 days straight at one time?
That was before I left Arizona. That was when I knew I had to get out of Arizona because it was just stuff was too good there and too, you know, too strong, and I don't know, it was crazy.
Awake for 10 straight days.
10 straight days, no sleep. I counted backwards because I didn't realize it. I'm staying up in this house with like four other people and just like, you know, drinking beers and listening to music and doing crystal meth.
And you're divorced at this point.
I am divorced at this point.
Okay, yep. So that happened, then you went away with
Well, I went away to Arizona and the divorce papers came in the mail to me while I was in Arizona.
Okay, got you. Okay.
That was a day party, you know.
Yeah. Right.
And so you ended up where after that?
After that, I took a bus to California.
Because you had a place to live and...
Because I thought I had a place lined up, but it didn't work out that way. So I ended up I was homeless on the streets in California, sleeping behind a hedgerow off the side of the freeway and waking up in the morning and going to work at Labor Ready for like $40, $50 a day if they had work for me.
And that was enjoyable? You enjoyed that?
Not at all, no. That was, you know, I mean, that was a time where, man, I didn't have food for a couple of days sometimes, you know, and... you watch people throw away food and you get sad, you know, because you see a little kid coming out of a store throwing away food and you're starving to death. That's know what that feels like, and that sucks.
That's what I wanted to ask you, because like with that experience now, you have to look at homeless people different than most people.
Yeah, I give a guy a ride down the street. I see him 3 days. This guy's name today, he says he stays in a hotel, but I think he's homeless. And, you know, try to give him some money and stuff like that. And I don't care, really, if he goes and uses money for beer, because I know that when I was sleeping on the street, it was a lot easier to fall asleep if you had a beer before. You know, I don't care. You know, I mean...
You didn't have to go to sleep hungry for the pain.
And I said that to Shawnee, and then Shawnee said, well, somewhere in Proverbs it says that.
Yeah. See, though, even now, that experience of that terrible experience you walk through, God is using in who
I'm
you are
now. I'm hoping I'll be able to invite him to the Bible study eventually.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, while all this is going on, you've been on a downward slide for about 10 years now, more than that, 10 years. Mm-hmm. Partying, living the life, relationships,
all this
stuff. He said it was
from age 16 to 33.
Yeah.
And so, but it's been just about, just over 10 years, maybe about 12 years. Now you find yourself homeless and hungry. Mm-hmm. Any time in any of this you thought, well, I wonder what God thinks, or I wonder how I get my life on track, or you
at,
just...
At that time, you know what, I didn't think about what God thought, because I thought that was a bunch of bull crap. Because I had just been so turned off by it, and I like programmed my mind to think that. And what I did, I think I told her when I got to California, I stopped doing the crystal meth, and I decided to start living right because of karma. You know, I didn't steal.
What goes around comes around.
You're very spiritual there.
Yeah, because I didn't. They want to. So I didn't steal. I didn't do anything, and things actually went right for me because you know, I got and things fell into place. But eventually, you know, I mean, it's still karma's still a hopeless area. What is that? Yeah, it's not. It's
so
not
you
real.
Made some positive choices, though.
Yeah, because, what I did is I made good choices.
Right,
made better choices,
which is good karma. So,
yeah.
And
so,
then what though? What happened?
Eventually, you know, you don't make a good choice. You slip. Yeah, it doesn't. If it's not, if you haven't had an inward change, you're not gonna. You ain't gonna be able to hold it up forever. And I made stupid choices.
And
drank too much, whatever, didn't show for work.
Okay, so how long did you live on the street?
I was maybe a couple of weeks on the street, because then I started working. I got together with a couple guys from Labor Ready, and we, like, four or five guys in one hotel room, you know what I mean? Yeah, and working daily labor. And I was able to work my way out of that because I got hired on by a guy who had me working for him in construction, and he paid me better than Labor Ready did. And one of the guys that worked for him also helped put me up, let me stay in his garage and help me out to save up money for a couple of weeks. So I eventually had my own hotel room for $224 a week. I got the receipts from it still at the Regency Hotel
in
Newport Beach. And I was making about $320. So I had $100 left over to do for my food and whatever for the week and do my laundry. And yeah, I think I afforded myself one night to go have this Vietnamese or Cambodian barbecue and a couple of beers.
Wow. And so this guy, just to, I mean, really make a point of the intimacy of God. So this guy really showed grace on you and said, here, you can stay in my...
The guy who I worked for, not the guy who, let me stay wasn't a Christian, but the guy who I worked for who owned the company, his name was Chip Cox. He was a Christian. He went to Calvary Chapel out there. He tried to get me to go.
Get out.
Yeah, but I didn't, you know, I didn't go in for it, but yeah.
But see, he was, in his heart, he was being
used
by God.
He really, he was extra, you know, to even hire me on from labor, you're not supposed to do it. He took me in and said, you're a real good worker, you know, and he's just real nice, and gave me a lot of chances. He seen I was starting to drink too much, and he still let me, he tried to help me out the best he could, and Chip did.
Wow.
He was a good guy.
So how long did that go on? What kind of progressed from there?
That I worked for him for maybe 8 months, I think, and then... I messed up, and eventually I messed up so much that he had to let me go. But at that point, I rented a room with a guy who was a mailman in the area. He was cool. He was a cool guy, and he was real nice to me too. He like $300 a month, real cheap.
Yeah.
I got to stay in a room with him, and he had a ping pong table. He liked to smoke a lot of weed, and he was just like and drank every night. But he was a nice guy, and but when I lost my job, he was nice enough to take me up to San Pedro, and I. Put my name on a bunch of boats there. That's where the commercial fishing fleet was around there. So I decided to start going fishing because I didn't know how else to make money, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're fishing, you're out there for months, right?
On the boats out there, it was just like a couple day thing because they're seining. So you're out we were fishing, we'd go out at night, we'd seine for anchovies or sardines and come back in and pack them in. Yeah.
So was it good money or was it just adequate?
It would have been good money if our captain would have kept us busy, but he, like I said, he was going back and forth. He lived in Canada, and like so, we would make a trip and then he'd be gone for a week.
Were you using that money for drugs at all at this point?
I didn't have enough to use it for drugs, but I would go to the bar and hang out, and I was living on the boat, staying and watching his dog while I'd be gone. So I had food, all the food I wanted, because the boat's full of food. And I just I budget my money so I could go out and have a little bit of a social life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But no drugs because I couldn't afford them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't start doing drugs until I moved to Ventura. I'd smoke weed, but not until I went to Ventura and that guy left.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had nowhere to live, and I started living with some locals in Ventura, and I met Megan, and Megan was doing crystal. She was a very functioning addict at the time. You know, she would buy a bag of crystal meth and just use it before work and a little bit here and there. And she got, and so I was like, oh, I'll do a little bit with her too. It didn't take very long for me to go well beyond functioning addict. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I was like, you know, I went right down to where I wanted to do it like crazy, you know, and yeah. I wanted to do a lot of it.
So at this point, you continue to progress in your life. You're growing older. Your life is moving forward, but you're not really going anywhere.
Nowhere.
Have you gotten in any trouble at this point?
I hadn't gotten any trouble in California yet, but I started running with the, you know, I mean, when you're doing crystal meth and you don't really have a whole lot of money. I was making on the party boats, making pretty good money, but I was doing a lot of crystal too. So I started hanging with the dealers, hanging with the bikers, selling, driving around girls at night. You know, working girls, you know, I mean, I'd be out until 3-4 in the morning driving around all high, and eventually I got pulled over and I had stuff on me. So I got my first possession charge. You know, and I went to jail for a little bit, but they let you right out, and they get you on a drug program. And from there, I think I ended up with probably 4 altogether possession charges, also possession of a stolen motor vehicle, and a few other things mixed in there, too.
So I racked up quite a list of felonies. Yeah, I was just going to say that. Quite a list of charges.
Yes.
Then. Uh-huh. And so life has turned out just how you wanted it to when you were a kid. You dreamt of being a felon, addict.
Not at all. Not really. By the time I left California, I had spent 2 of the 7 years I was there, all added up together, in jail.
Wow.
You know. Wow.
And so your relationship then with your family?
Very limited. I didn't call my family out here much when I needed something because they usually turn me down. But they would mail me Reese's Cups and $20 every holiday. Because I like Reese's Cups.
Well, and I think we can, as we kind of bring this time to a close, we're going to continue to talk to Chris, but we can fill in a little bit of a gap because on this end, mom and dad, family is praying, talking with your family. They're not sure if you're alive sometimes.
Yes.
There were times when you were getting so strung out and in trouble, and they're like, we're waiting for the phone call that says he's dead.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's where your life was headed. Is that safe to say, right?
Oh, yeah, it's real safe to say. When they came out to see me, they saw what I looked like. You know, that drug doesn't leave you but half the person you were.
So we're going to just kind of leave with your story in California. Mm-hmm. Destitute, strung out, addict. You know, your life is basically going one direction. And not only nowhere, but headed for death.
Yeah.
And as we pick this up, we want to remind people the reason we have this show is to bring hope. And if this story strikes a bell with you, there's hope for you. And you'll want to make sure and catch this continuation. But we also want you to go to the website, www.themattmarestory.com, because there you'll find inspirational writings. Matt writes from prison, and there are resources there. And we also want to encourage you that if you're finding yourself or one of your loved one in this kind of a cycle, there is hope, and there is help. And we want to just encourage you that direction.
Absolutely. And we are going to pick this up. And for some of you, it will be 2 weeks in between shows, but we ask you to be patient. You're going to get the second half of this show, and we end all of our shows with our theme, which is from Psalm 46:10, which says, when you're in a crisis, be still and know that He is God.